Good evening. This is Valerie Jackson in conversation with some of today's most dynamic artists, innovative thinkers, and interesting personalities. Tonight, in conversation with Atlanta Mayor Kasim Reed. Now in his third year in office, he's garnered support from Democrats and Republicans alike. Some have said that it's his pragmatic and bottom-line approach to issues that make him one of the most influential mayors in the nation. The Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies honored him with the prestigious Lewis E. Martin Great American Award for his new and creative approach to leadership. Perhaps that approach comes from being a young entrepreneur at 9 when he started his own lawn service, complete with business cards, I might add. That creative approach paid for his college and law degrees from Howard University, where in 2002 he became the youngest general trustee of the university. Mayor Reed honed his political skills for 2 terms in the Georgia House of Representatives and 7 years in the Georgia State Senate. Join me, Valerie Jackson, in conversation with Atlanta Mayor Kasim Reed.
Hi, Valerie. How are you? This shows what happens when you come into an interview with someone that knows Atlanta like the back of her hand. So she has already shown a knowledge of facts that many people do not have.
Well, thank you.
Referencing my lawn care service in Loch Lomond in my old neighborhood when I was growing up.
At 9 years old, right.
It's a true story.
I know. I am very impressed with it. So let's talk about that young entrepreneur at 9 years old in Loch Lomond community. I know about the mayor and the state senator and the representative and the Howard guy, but who is this seven-year-old? What did you want to be?
I grew up in a house full of heroes. My brothers and my dad were my heroes, and I really just tried to mimic them. I mean, I'm the youngest of 4 boys, and so my older brothers are 4 to 5 and 6 years older than me, and my mom had them one after another. So it was about a 4-year break before I came, and so I just looked up to my brothers, and they really shaped me. So I had a very old-fashioned household in terms of my mom and dad preparing meals every night, being at the table, academically demanding, and it's kind of corny. My childhood was pretty corny. I lived off Cascade Road in a neighborhood called Loch Lomond, Loch Lomond Estates, across from Nisky Lake, and that's where things started for me. And the reason that I started the lawn care business is, if anybody knows those neighborhoods, they have big yards. And there were some older kids in the neighborhood that could actually push the lawn more, but they couldn't get the work. So I would go and knock on the door, and then
So you were the broker, huh?
Yeah.
You were the salesman.
That's right. Okay. I would go and knock on the door. I had a card, and the slogan for my business said, "Help the kid." I remember that was my slogan. And so I would go in, and we would charge $14 for the front. And then $28 for the back, front and
that
back.
That was quite a bit back
yeah.
then, though,
and
wasn't
then
it?
And then we could get it because we were kids.
Oh, look at them working hard,
yeah,
huh? That
exactly.
kind of thing.
Yeah. People would come by and look at us and say how proud they were.
Before you wanted to be a landscaper,
that was good.
What did you want to be at 5 or 6? Did you want to be like a doctor or a singer?
No, what happened to me was my dad used to talk about Thurgood Marshall. And so I didn't really get it, but whenever folks would talk about Dr. King, he always talked about Thurgood Marshall as an implementer of Dr. King's dream. So, you know, I grew up in a household with folks like C.T. Vivian, an extraordinary civil rights leader, would come by my house. Dorothy Cotton, who was a part of the civil rights movement. These were folks who would be in my house when I was a boy. So I heard about Thurgood Marshall. We had the old Encyclopedia Britannicus that every household used to have. Which were used for book reports.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the first grade or so, I remember our teacher telling us we had to do a book report. I did a book report on Thurgood Marshall and a painting. You had to do a book report and finger painter. And my painting didn't come out too well. But that's when I learned about, got the idea that I wanted to be a lawyer. And it's driven by your dad. You don't ever really.
But your father wasn't a lawyer.
No, but he would have been one if he hadn't have had four kids by the time he was 22.
Mm-hmm.
So he made a different life decision. My mom got pregnant, and my parents got pregnant when they were sophomores at Claflin. And they decided that they were going to raise their family. So my dad stopped school to raise his kids. And as I said, they had three kids in a row. So by the time my dad was 22 or 23, he had three sons. And he was totally committed to raising us. And so I think that a lot of his dreams he shared with me, and I think that they, along with my mother's encouragement, formed who I am.
Now, your mother's encouragement leaned toward the more creative, I suspect, since she was a singer and a dancer, actor.
My mom went to college on a scholarship for voice. So she.
So no wonder you were singing like Michael Jackson around the house. They tell me about it. Yeah. They said you used to do Michael Jackson.
I was a huge Michael Jackson fan. I won many dance competitions imitating Michael Jackson.
Get out of here.
Yeah, across the city. Yeah, I did. That was about 70 pounds ago, but I could do Michael Jackson as well as anybody during that time.
Well, I'm going to have an amateur contest night, and I'm going to invite you to do that.
Please do.
Okay.
But that's what shaped me.
Yeah.
But I remember that book report. I remember that Thurgood Marshall went to Howard University. That was the first time I became aware of Howard University. But basically, that stuck with me.
And you went. So
and
you
that's
went
where
to
I was going.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, is it true or false that you paid for your education at Howard with profits from a 14-carat gold jewelry business?
It is true that I paid for most of my tuition at Howard. You see, when I decided, my dad wanted me to go to the University of Georgia. So when I decided to go to Howard, we stopped speaking for a period of time because he was very strong-willed. And he had a specific plan for my life. And he wanted me to go into politics, and he thought that the best road for that was to go to the flagship institution of the state. And he is, you know, so he had his idea, and I wanted to go to Howard. Because of the money that I had made from a lawn care business and a 14-karat gold jewelry business. I know that you remember during the 80s, everybody had a gold herringbone necklace.
That's true.
Everybody had a herringbone bracelet or necklace. And all my friends in high school had either the ram kind of bamboo styled earrings in gold. And I realized that we had at the apparel mart, you could go and buy gold that was in the stores. But, you know, you had to make a minimum purchase to buy at the apparel mart. So I took the money that I made from my lawn care service and went in and bought gold. Well, at that time, gold jewelry was marked up at 300 to 400%. Now there's just a regular margin on jewelry. But back then, you could buy a herringbone chain, a regular herringbone, a triple herringbone, a quad herringbone chain for $80 and sell it for $200 or $300. I was a member of Ben Hill United Methodist Church, so I used to sell gold jewelry to my mother's friends at Ben Hill, and I used to sell gold jewelry to my friends at Six Flags, because in Atlanta, everybody worked at Six Flags during the summers. So you knew there were people that were getting checks all during the summer, and people would go back to school with jewelry. So I did reasonably well. I did well enough to leave and buy a Delta plane ticket to go to Howard. So I went to school alone. Because my dad didn't agree with my school choice. And my mother took me to the airport and put me on a plane. And I showed up at Howard and I paid my tuition. I mean, I walked up and I paid my bills.
Well, you not only paid your bills, though. Andy Young loves to brag about the fact that you formed an organization or helped to found an organization called Independence Fund?
Yeah, I created a fundraising initiative at Howard that today has raised more than $11 million. And basically what I did was convince, there was a federal matching fund that was directed at HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities, that I learned about while I worked for Congressman Joseph Kennedy. And it required a contribution which was matched dollar for dollar by the federal government to encourage giving to endowments at HBCUs. It was a targeted initiative to HBCUs. And I convinced the student body to assess themselves $15 a semester, which was then matched dollar for dollar by the federal government. Well, Howard has 10,000 kids, so it's $30 a year, so that's $300,000 a year. Then this match dollar for dollar, that's a $600,000 contribution. And then we had a hold period, so you couldn't spend any of the proceeds, so you could build a big enough corpus to throw off interest income. And it's a part of the endowment, so the program that I created is one of the three or four largest gifts in the history
and
of Howard
University.
And it's
still ongoing.
And it goes on today.
That's outstanding, yeah. Outstanding. We're going to take a short station break, and we'll be back in conversation with Atlanta Mayor Kasim Reed in just a moment. This is Valerie Jackson, back in conversation this evening with Atlanta Mayor Kasim Reed. Well, it's no wonder that you wanted to move on and spread your wings even further. So your first run for office was for the House of Representatives, 1998 in Atlanta, in Georgia.
I want to be honest. My first run was for Fulton County Commission. Against Emma Darnell when I was 21, and I was overly confident. So that show, there's one fact that Valerie Jackson was not aware of. So I mean, I had to
I just
point
forgot.
That out. And Emma Darnell completely took me to school. I thought that I was I thought I had graduated from Howard. I believed that I belonged in office immediately. Never mind that I didn't own a home, had never been employed anywhere, or never did anything in my career, which Commissioner Darnell did a great job of explaining to the public. And then she beat me so badly that she sent me to law school. So I owe Emma Darnell enormous thanks.
That?
No, and then I went back, and I really needed that. It was good that it happened then, because the pain of losing, I think, is the reason that I work so hard today, because I know what it feels like to lose.
So describe your standard operating procedure in the General Assembly. Just quickly kind of give us an idea of what the role of a House of a representative is.
Well, one, it is to represent the interests of the constituents who sent you there to the best of your ability, and to exercise your best judgment and thinking on their behalf after doing solid work to understand the issues. Because when you are a member of the legislature, you literally deal with hundreds of issues, and you owe the voters your energy and your full devotion. I view, much in the fashion that your husband, Maynard Jackson, viewed public service as a blessing. I understand it as a blessing. I don't believe that I do people a favor when I'm in elected office. I believe that they have done a favor to me by allowing them to serve. So that's how I approached it. And what I wanted to do was I learned the job. I am very old fashioned in terms of my work ethic, in terms of believing that you have to understand the job to execute it. I remember my first year in the General Assembly, I spent probably 5 hours a week just studying the rules of the General Assembly, because I understand how important part of parliamentary procedure is. In a legislature, that is the tool that is used to become a good legislator. And I grew up admiring Lyndon Baines Johnson, read Robert Caro's volumes on Lyndon Johnson and his time in the Senate. And there was a book called Master of the Senate, which is one of my favorite books in a series on Lyndon Johnson. And that book emphasized the importance of learning the rules of a legislative body. And that has held me in good stead and holds me in good stead to this day.
Does that have anything to do with when often I've heard reporters say that you began to accumulate political capital.
Yes.
Talk about what, for those of us who may not understand, what is political capital? How do you create political capital? And then how do you use it?
Yeah. You create political capital by doing good and then having the ability to execute your popularity or your gifts. So if you know, if you can imagine,
so it's not about you rub my back and I rub yours, or you.
That's a part of it, but really, it's cumulative. It's like, it's really like when you see somebody who's special or gifted, they accumulate people. It's like Maynard Jackson. When your husband was around or in a room, people were drawn to him. They followed him. They agreed to do things at his request. That is accumulating political capital. And you have to decide when it is appropriate to use it, because it is like a bank.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it gathers and it gathers and it gathers, and you pour out good and good. And
you better not start calling wolf.
That's right. And the public will expands and contracts. That's what I think a lot of politicians don't understand. Mm-hmm. No politician always has the public with them. It's a constant exchange. So the public is constantly monitoring you to make a judgment about whether you are exercising your office in a way that they appreciate.
Mm-hmm.
To the extent that they like it, what do? They give you more, right? Mm-hmm. So when your husband wanted to move a freeway to build the modern Hartsfield-Jackson Airport, he did it with massive public support, because the public had seen his stewardship and gave him more. To the extent that the public doesn't like what you do, they withdraw their support and it contracts your ability to do things. Mm-hmm. And it's really something that is not concrete at all. You can feel it in the environment, though. I can tell how I'm doing in a grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
You can walk into a grocery store and you can see how the public looks at you and speaks to you and get a sense of how you're doing. You can walk into the same grocery store when you're not doing well and you can feel them withdraw. You can feel people turn away from you, avoid eye contact with you, not move towards you. And so I believe that politics expands and contracts, and people that are good at politics understand their space and time. So you don't try to do something massive when the will is not there.
Mm-hmm.
And you should, the stadium is an example of that. I believe that building the new stadium was the right 20-30 year decision for the city. But a lot of people in the current environment didn't believe that that was the right decision today, because mm-hmm. of what we're all going through.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that the public supported me enough and believed that I had done a good enough job in a number of other areas to allow me to make the judgment call that I made based upon the results that I've gotten in other areas. And so the public will give you that.
And that's exactly what's been demonstrated, because even though there was a great deal of controversy over this, and many mm-hmm. people criticized the stadium, saying that we were giving money to a project that, when we have greater needs like mm-hmm. the homeless and mm-hmm. that our education system. So how did you personally convince the neighborhoods that the construction of an NFL football stadium would have a positive impact on the community, especially if they have been disappointed with the return on the investment of the original stadium,
mm-hmm.
the dome that's there now?
Well, there are a number of things. One, I have a record of behavior. And what I've done as mayor is honor my commitment, and I have a lengthy record in 3 years of doing what I say I will do to the extent that I am able to. So I think that mattered. Two, if you contrast the arrangement we made with the community, $15 million in private philanthropy from the Arthur Blank Foundation, $15 million in community support from the city of Atlanta. It dwarfs what was done in the Georgia Dome arrangement. In the Georgia Dome arrangement, there were $8 million in housing assistance that was provided, and the full $8 million was never deployed. And the stadium was built with 100% public money. So in our arrangement, the stadium is being built with 80% of Arthur Blank's money. So 80% private money, 20% public money. But the deeper issue is that Atlanta's core business is our hospitality and convention industry. It's one of our four core businesses. And your husband helped to create that. Last week, we celebrated 40,400,000 visitors to this town. So that puts us on par with Las Vegas, Los Angeles, and San Diego. That supports jobs for about 220,000 people who clean the rooms in our hotels, who prepare meals in our hotels, who have middle-class jobs in our hotels, who support our restaurants. So I had to look to the larger issue of our overall economy, and I made the call that an 80% investment private, 20% investment that didn't represent a tax increase, no taxes went up, and 85% of those costs are coming from people who don't live in the city of Atlanta, and the Atlanta Falcons are going to play in downtown for another 30 years. So that's the conversation that I had with the neighborhood. They've responded very favorably to that. And I think it's going to get better and better.
What about the local vendors who have been banned now from many sites?
Yeah.
And they're saying that that's creating even more unemployment.
Yeah, I think they don't know what they're talking about, and they're too smart by half. The local vendors that have been complaining sued the city of Atlanta. They sued the city of Atlanta to invalidate an ordinance. They won. So when they won, we tried to settle. So we offered to settle and enter into an agreement where they would have been able to allow to vend. They didn't settle. They went to judgment. So they felt that they had a strong hand, and they played it out, Valerie. And then they won, and it invalidated the ordinance. So right now, there is no ordinance for vending. Now we're working to create a new one. But I'm not going to rush into that. But I do think I think if it weren't so serious, it would be funny to listen to people who got what they want. Mm-hmm. They sued for the current state of affairs and they won.
So be careful what you wish
exactly.
for.
Exactly. So now to look at me and tell me that I'm the bad guy. Well, no, I'm not the bad guy. You outsmarted yourself. What you should have done is when the city presented the opportunity to come to a fair arrangement, you should have accepted that. So you won. Now there's no ordinance. We're going to create a thoughtful ordinance and we'll put it before council. But I'm not going to be the bad guy. I didn't go and knock the battery or block off anybody's shoulder. Mm-hmm. I was minding my own business. The city was sued. They won. They got what they wanted. And now a number of these folks are running around attempting to make the city look like it's some bad party.
Well, recently you've been looking pretty good, though, in the overall picture. Mm-hmm. Since you've been in office, there are no property tax increase. The budget has been balanced. Mm-hmm. You reformed the pension for employees. And I'd like for you to just very quickly say how that reform was and what is the result of that.
The pension reform was the second hardest thing that I've done since I've been in office. The stadium was harder. But what it did was to keep a promise with our employees. Basically, the pension system was underfunded by $1.5 billion, meaning that if the employees became eligible and went to cash their check, they would have gotten 51 to 55 cents on a dollar. And that is someone who's 65 years old, who doesn't have an opportunity to go and recapture any of their life back. They're 65. They have worked. Well, my concern was is that if we didn't address the underfunded pension, then a mayor who does not have the heart that I have would have used that as an excuse to invalidate the pension commitments, mm-hmm. right? Because you would have claimed exigent circumstances because the pension costs were growing at between 10% and 13% a year. And so another elected official could have said that this situation is so bad that we need to invalidate our pension arrangements and broken faith with our pensioners. Now what's going to happen is the check that our people have is a good check. You're going to be able to cash it, and you're going to be able to get 100 cents on the dollar. And that's why every employee union and every single member of Atlanta City Council endorsed our reforms, because they knew we were going broke, Valerie. We were spending 18% of cash on pension payments.
So what was the main thing that turned around?
The main thing that we did, one is our employees who wanted to keep the pension that they have are paying more for it in partnership with the city. Oh. So if you said, I want to retire with 80% of my income, that requires a bigger contribution. So you went from 8% to 13%, but you get to keep what you wanted to keep, which is when you walk out of that building, you're getting 80 cents of your last salary. But we changed the vesting period because we had a situation, Valerie, where you could retire and fully vest after 10 years. Who does that? So you were fully vested after 10 years with pension and health care. And so we had some folks that were retiring in their 40s and going and working a new job, and we were picking up their health care costs. So we changed the vesting period in the city of Atlanta. And we also are moving new employees into a defined benefit program. So it's a mix of things that we did. But you know what? We're paying down our liability. We've saved $270 million over 10 years, $500 million over 30. And you know what, Valerie? In this budget, not a single employee in the city is being furloughed or laid off.
Mm. Wow, that's outstanding. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about some of the other challenges that you've been through recently, not the least of which being the situation with the Atlanta School Board. Mm-hmm. Education is so, so important. Talk about the relationship between the mayor and the school board, because there's a lot of misconceptions about who runs what, who has the authority to do this or do that, and I think we need to kind of clear it up a little
bit. Well, that's one of the things that I regret not being able to talk to Mayor Jackson about, was whether he would have taken control over the school system or not, because he was probably the last mayor that was popular enough to have done that, strong enough to have done that. My relationship with the current board is very favorable. I like their chairman. I like Ruben a lot. And I think that the superintendent has provided tremendous public service, leading the job as the chancellor of the state, having been a private sector CEO, Fortune 1000 CEO. I think he's made an enormous contribution to the city of Atlanta. I think the next phase for us is attracting a world-class superintendent. So, you know, my feeling about the school board is about what is next for us. Mm-hmm. And that's why I've gotten a group of CEOs who have committed to double the salary of the next superintendent if it is a superintendent that we believe is a star.
Double the salary?
Double.
Would that be double. Difficult to do considering?
Wouldn't be difficult for me. But I want to be clear
but
about
how much
this,
authority
Valerie.
Do you have? Do you have oversight selected?
But I have the authority, enough authority to call CEOs, and if somebody's making $300,000, they can make $600,000. I can raise $300,000 a year from the corporate community. And I'm not talking about just for anybody. Mm-hmm. The superintendent I have in mind is somebody who is moving towards the end of their career, are not even considering coming to Atlanta, mm-hmm. have an amazing track record. But if I were 55 years old or 57 and I had had a great career and I wanted one more challenge, maybe I'd like to double my compensation for 5 to 7 years in an environment where we're telling you it's challenged. So when I go and knock on your door, yeah. we're going to lay all of the ugliness out. But, you know, we've got to start recruiting people in education like we recruit football coaches at the University of Georgia. We've got to put our passion into it. And then you've got to give that person who has a verifiable, proven track record of winning the tools they need to win. So they'll get to tell me who else that they need to bring in. But where I'm looking to go is radical reform. And I don't have the legal authority to do that. The APS system is completely separate from the city of Atlanta system. But I do have the political capital to do that. Mm-hmm. That's where I think things are going.
So what do you think? Did we learn a lesson from this recent problem with the school?
I did. I think we learned Mikhail Gorbachev's quote, trust but verify. Mm. No, that's Ronald Reagan's quote, trust but verify. You know, we won't have a cheating situation like we had again, because there will be an enormous amount of scrutiny and verification, which will be healthy and will prevent our children from being cheated in the fashion that they've been cheated over the last 10 years.
Do you see a positive fate for public schools, or is it going to be a long journey trying to get there?
I think it's going to be a positive fate for public schools in the city of Atlanta, because what our city has shown is that we have the will to change things that we don't like. Mm-hmm. So when you look at Grady was going off of the cliff, the only level one trauma hospital in Northeast Georgia was going over a cliff. The corporate and civic community in our town raised $200 million in cash. You look at what Grady is today, it is a place that you or I, with all of the warts, the process wasn't perfect. There are things that I would have done differently, but with all of the warts, Grady is a place that you could walk into and feel that you will receive mm-hmm. very high quality care right now. And 8 months ago, it was on the brink of insolvency and disappearing. Mm. So that is an example of what happens in Atlanta if we decide.
We'll be back after this short break and continue our conversation with Atlanta Mayor Kasim Reed. Welcome back. This is your host, Valerie Jackson. Joining me in the studio this evening in conversation is Atlanta's own Mayor Kasim Reed. We'll continue our discussion now with the mayor on issues relevant to the city and the surrounding communities. In spite of the Olympic spirit, the legacy mm-hmm. of civil and human rights, so much compassion in one city, yet we still have a serious homeless problem
You're right.
in Atlanta.
You're right.
Do we know what the bottlenecks are?
Do we
have the resources to solve them?
We do. We're moving on homelessness. I mean, we won the city of Atlanta $3.1 million Bloomberg Innovation Delivery Grant, which has funded best-in-class individuals to come in and examine our homelessness population. We hired a woman named Kristen Wilson, who is doing a terrific job by all accounts. We also hired a woman named Susan Lampley. The city of Atlanta never would have been able to afford those kind of seasoned executives to lead in this effort. But more than the hires we've made, let's look at the results that we've had in 18 months. Since we won the Bloomberg Innovation Delivery Grant, the President of the United States.
Now, excuse me, sir. Explain what that is.
What it is is Bloomberg Philanthropies, which is funded by Michael Bloomberg, the mayor of New York. selected five mayors in America and basically said, tell me a problem that you have, and I'll fund the research of that problem so that you can execute a plan without the overhead. And so I was one of five mayors in America that was selected, and my focus was homelessness, primarily because of the influence of Mayor Shirley Franklin and her extraordinary work in the homelessness space, and delivering a 311 center for the city of Atlanta to improve the customer experience with our city. But what it's allowed us to do is the president said that he issued a challenge to American cities to house 100 veterans in 100 days. The city of Atlanta was the number one city in America. We housed 114 veterans in 100 days. And as I sit here right now, we've housed 340 chronically homeless veterans.
Wow.
Now, they're a part of the homeless population,
mm-hmm.
but veterans come with extensive wraparound services and support.
And 40% of the men that are homeless are veterans.
Exactly. But what it does is it shows us how to do it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because once you house a veteran, you get experience with how to rapidly take a person with a chronic challenge in their lives and get them housed. We also had 190 individuals who went out on a very cold night and actually interviewed 640 homeless people and talked to them and got their name and really found out what happened,
mm-hmm.
which we hadn't done before. We just had this general idea that there were 800 homeless people, or we had not gone out and walked up to people under a bridge and gotten their data, so that we can really start diagnosing what goes on that puts you in the space where you are comfortable living on under a bridge.
Or
every
you
day.
Have to live in your car,
yes.
you know, because you don't have a house.
So what we're going to do is we have a goal to house 1,000 chronically homeless people by the end of my first term.
How do they qualify for that? What's the criteria for who's disabled? The criteria changes.
One, chronically homeless individuals are people who have been without shelter for 6 months or more. So, and I am adding a requirement that you be from Atlanta, because my priority are people who are from here. So I want to be real clear about that. The people who are going to be sourced by the city are going to be people who were City of Atlanta residents, because that's who I was hired mm-hmm. to care for. So those are going to be the people that have a priority, and we're going to achieve our objective. We're going to house more than 1,000 homeless people. We're going to be able to show you where they are, and we're going to be engaged in their lives in a different way. One example is the Imperial Hotel. The Imperial Hotel and a public-private partnership is going to be a model.
You mean
of
the old Imperial Hotel that was burned down
as we speak is being completely renovated. And when it's done, you would think that it is a middle-income apartment building.
Well, walking hand in hand with homelessness, though, is unemployment.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because it's almost like Catch-22 or the chicken before the egg.
Yes.
The unemployment issue, it's a confusing one in a way, because 40 to 60% of homeless people do work
mm-hmm.
in some form or fashion.
Yes.
So it's not like they're out there just homeless and not
or
trying.
Lazy.
Right. So how do we change that perception?
Well, I think we changed the perception by changing the reality. I mean, the reality mm-hmm. is that we were in the worst economy since Franklin Delano Roosevelt was president. That is the reality. But, you know, I don't complain about the hand that has been dealt to the city of Atlanta. Unemployment in the region when I became mayor was 10.2%. Today, unemployment is at about 8.2%, which is still unacceptably mm-hmm. high. But I live in a world of comparison and contrast. And so when I walked in the door, it was much worse. If you look at the most recent jobs report, you know, one of the reasons I was so focused on the stadium and tourism, 5,600 jobs, the leading sector of job creation in our region was in the convention, tourism, and hospitality space. 5,600 people got jobs in this space. So
What I have to do is you see me engaged in effort after effort to attract jobs to the region. I am constantly doing it. That's what the location of the Porsche headquarters for North America on the airport campus, where there'll be more than 300 jobs. That's what keeping the headquarters for Carter's in downtown Atlanta is doing. We're working really hard to encourage Coca-Cola to bring more and more jobs into the heart of the city, working really hard asking AT&T to bring more and more jobs to the city. I'm working on no less than three business relocations as we speak to come into the city of Atlanta, which I can't share at this time, but that is what it is about.
Atlanta is a city of festivals.
Yes.
Major events, the 4th of July Peachtree Road Race. So tell us, sir, what is Atlanta's plan in case of any kind of a major disruption? What is our security protocol for something like
fortunately,
the Boston Marathon?
We have so much experience at this that we have been really growing and developing our plan for
from
years.
From 96.
No question.
Olympic bombing in 96.
But you know, our plan is we've stood up the biggest police force in the history of Atlanta. We now have 1,900 officers headed towards 2,000. So we have the capability to deploy a bigger footprint to protect the Peachtree Road Race, the 6.2 miles of the race. So that's going to be a part of it. The second thing that we have today that we've not had in the past is the most advanced video technology capability that we have had in the history of the city. We will build that out even further prior to the road race. So that is going to be a part of our planning. So we're working entirely in concert with the Atlanta Track Club. And in the past, the Atlanta Track Club basically hired off-duty officers, and they generally provided security. Well, those days are gone. We're going to fully stand up a force to make sure that the race is protected. And I'm not going to go much further in to tell you how we're going to do it, because I don't want to inform,
of course,
terrorists or bad people.
Are you working with the state and with the federal
We're working across
protocol?
The region. I happen to chair the group called UASI, which is the Urban Area Security Initiative that runs across 10 counties. So this is a situation where we're really asking for help from our state and federal partners, because of the importance of keeping 60,000 people who are going to come to our city to run 6.2 miles safe and to get them back home.
Well, sir, if you had to say something that you need more of other than money, you know, to run the city, what resource would you say that is? What do you need more of?
I think that people in Atlanta and in the region need to be more passionate about the city. So I'd say more passion. I think that people who live in Atlanta don't take enough time to realize the incredible story of a city that was burned to the ground as a part of the Civil War. And I think that when you compare what has been accomplished in the city of Atlanta, in the region, and in the state of Georgia, to almost every other major area in America, but certainly the South, it's really quite an amazing story. And I think that more passion would cause more people to stand up when you see people who are part of the region rooting against or rooting for failure of the capital city, which is the economic engine of the Southeast and of the state of Georgia. And it is almost a form in my mind of self-hate. And so I would say more passion for the city.
What do you feel most passionate about accomplishing as mayor? What is the one thing you really want to accomplish?
I want to leave the city in the healthiest shape that it has been since I've been alive. And so health would apply to its financial health. Health would apply to it being a safe haven for children and families. Health would apply to our economy being economically strong and a center of commerce in the Southeast, and health would apply to it being the center of the Southeast. My job as mayor is to wake up in every morning and make sure that Atlanta is the most important and successful city in the Southeast.
So if you had the power to change just one thing, what would it be?
The power to change one thing. That's a tough one. I think if I had the power to change one thing, it would be a higher level of cooperation among governments and citizens in our region, because I think we can accomplish so much more together by working on the things that we agree on.
I think
it's one of the things that that I've enjoyed so much about being mayor is being able to work with Governor Nathan Deal on the things that we agree on, and really leaving the other matters off mm-hmm. to the side mm-hmm. for another day and for other folks.
What is the crisis today that faces Atlanta, or should I say the opportunity, depending on how you look at it?
I think the crisis that faces us is a 52% graduation rate in our high schools. Atlanta imports an enormous amount of talent. So we are still among the three leading cities in America in attracting people between the ages of 21 and 35, similarly sized cities. But if people who are raised in the city can't take advantage of the things that they see mm-hmm. because they don't have adequate training to participate, then they strike out in different ways. So if you're a kid, you know, and the only thing you see is a college campus that you can't get to because of the gates, then maybe when one of those students comes outside of that gate, you take action against that student or do something to harm someone else. So you can have a city that is a leading city in the world, and we're now a city whose aspiration should be global, mm-hmm. not regional, and have a 52% graduation rate, because that's a pretty heavy prison pipeline. If you look at all relevant statistical data for the 48% of the kids that did not complete school. And
sir,
I would like to find a way in my lifetime right. to move Atlanta's graduation rate up to 70 to 75%. That would be a good use of a life.
That would be outstanding, outstanding. So, sir, we know how hard you're working. It's obvious on all the projects that you're juggling at the same time. So tell me, what do you do on a personal note that helps you to maintain this balance and this passion? Do you have a daily ritual or something simple or silly or serious? I know I have to make up my bed every morning when I get up. First thing I do, make up my bed.
I have that too. I have to make up mine. But,
but your mother made you make yours up.
Yes. I have one Coca-Cola a day. That's a part of, that's a daily ritual for me. And then, I'm available 6 days a week. But on Sundays, I am unscheduled. And Sundays are the one day that I have to get myself together spiritually and really just to live my own life and do what I feel like doing. So unless there is something extraordinary
occurring.
So what
do you do
occurring,
when you do what you feel like doing? Are you golfer?
No.
Do you cook, yoga?
It actually changes, Valerie. Sunday is the one day where I wake up and I do whatever I want to do. And that really does change.
Mm-hmm.
But on Sundays, I wake up and whatever I think that I want to do, that's what I do on Sunday. So
because you're a single man.
Yeah, no, well, I'm not that single.
oh, really?
I'm not that single.
Should I go in there?
But, no, you shouldn't go there, but I'm not that single. But I wake up and I do what I want to do on Sundays. I live my life because the other 6 days, are the public's life,
that's
better than anybody.
Absolutely. Sir, just briefly, how would you describe your leadership style if someone asked you?
I would describe my leadership style as results oriented. I would describe my leadership style as being driven by a philosophy of winning.
Now, does that mean that anything goes for the bottom line? I mean, or
I don't think anything goes because I enjoy my freedom, you know. but I do believe that at the end of the day, people elect you to office to win for them, to deliver concrete results that you can explain and verify. And so I think that results drive me. Okay. And results that I explain, commitments that I make publicly. I think if you go back in the time I've occupied this office, I have a pretty good record of achieving the goals that I set for myself and for this city. And I think every time you win, you live a little longer.
I appreciate your straightforwardness and your transparency. Yeah, that was the word I was
looking for. Well, you're one of our city's treasures.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for letting me visit with you.
Thanks for joining us this evening. If you enjoyed this program and would like to listen to our audio archive, visit us at wabe.org/inconversation. This series is a production of WABE FM 90.1 and Public Broadcasting Atlanta. The producer for this program is Marjorie Greenbaum. The technical producer and editor is Mike Johns. Programming support by Lois Reitzes and Dave Baraswain. And I'm your host, Valerie Jackson. Thanks for listening. Good night. Thank you.